This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So I want to thank you for the opportunity to tell you about our work. And I've been really fortunate to be a CIRM grantee for a number of years, and I just want to tell you guys that this has made a huge difference to our work, and I think we wouldn't have been able to do a lot of what we've done without your support. So I'm a clinical geneticist, and my laboratory is broadly interested in questions of how organs form during development and how they regenerate in the adult. And we focus on a couple of different organs, and today I'm going to tell you about our work looking at the intestine, and particularly some of the ongoing projects in the lab. We only began our CIRM-funded work on this about a year ago, and thinking about how we can use stem cell therapy, both with endogenous stem cells as well as pluripotent stem cells, for thinking about inflammatory bowel disease in the future. So what I want to do today is first introduce inflammatory bowel disease, which is a very common disease of the GI tract. And after that, we're really fortunate that Rachel Bonner, who's a very eloquent young lady who has inflammatory bowel disease, will tell us a little bit about her experiences with the condition. And then I'll tell you about intestinal stem cells, and then a few of the projects, as I mentioned, that are ongoing in the lab, including mouse models of inflammatory bowel disease, a newer project that we've undertaken looking at how helminth infections affect stem cells in the gut, and then a couple slides at the end about the use of pluripotent cell-derived organoids. So inflammatory bowel disease is actually, as I mentioned, a common disease of the GI tract. It affects about 1 in 250 people, so more than a million people in the United States. And classically, it's been divided into two different types of conditions, Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. Inflammatory bowel disease is characterized by these recurrent episodes of relapsing and remitting inflammation. And in Crohn's disease, this happens from mouth to anus, and it affects the entire wall of the GI tract, whereas in ulcerative colitis, it's restricted to the colon and to the mucosal lining of the gut. And also, just to remind you, this is not to be confused with IBS or irritable bowel syndrome, which is a nervous colon. So just to give you a sense of the incidence of this, these graphs show the prevalence of Crohn's disease on the left and of ulcerative colitis on the right. As I mentioned, more than a million people in the United States right now who have inflammatory bowel disease, about half with Crohn's and half with ulcerative colitis, and the incidence of this increases as patients age. So in terms of the therapies for inflammatory bowel disease, these have really focused almost exclusively on the inflammatory component. And most of what I'm going to tell you about when we get to the science is that there's an additional part of the condition which is really underexplored and potentially has a lot of impact therapeutically, which is on the regenerative aspect of the condition, because after the inflammation occurs in the gut needs to heal. And that healing comes from stem cells, as we'll talk about in a minute. So the pathophysiology of inflammatory bowel disease can be summarized as an aberrant host immune response, so the immune system of the host responding inappropriately to otherwise commensal bacteria, meaning the bacteria that normally live in your gut, in an individual who has an underlying genetic predisposition. So it's essentially these several components where there needs to be inflammation responding to these bacteria that are normally present, and the individual has to have some sort of genetic predisposition. And there's been a lot of genetic studies done. There have been more than 160 different parts of the genome which have been identified in genome-wide association studies as predisposing people to inflammatory bowel disease. And as I said, the treatment, which is shown in this cartoon pyramid, involves a number of different agents, all of which primarily target the immune system, ranging from ASA to steroids to more potent immunomodulators to biologics, and finally surgery if needed. And again, none of the treatments that are currently used right now target regeneration of the epithelium. And so this epithelial, and I apologize for those of you who are eating right now, some of the pictures are a little bit graphic. The this regeneration of the epithelium is really the cornerstone of mucosal healing. And what mucosal healing means is absence of ulceration, and this is considered a key treatment goal which the gastroenterologists follow in inflammatory bowel disease. And it predicts sustained clinical remission as well as resection or surgery-free survival. And it results from suppression of inflammation and improvement of the epithelial barrier function. And so I should just say for the abbreviations that I'm using throughout here, CD stands for Crohn's disease. So those are the pictures on the left in which you can see a very inflamed mucousy colon in the top left and healing in the bottom left. And UC stands for ulcerative colitis, which is on the top right. And you can see the lesions that are present, and in response to the various therapies that the patient has been put upon, these are resolving. And so what we want to focus on in our lab is how can we harness this ability of the epithelium to regenerate based, as I'll show you in a minute, on the presence of these adult stem cells in order to target the stem cells and get them to perform better under conditions of disease. So just to introduce the adult stem cells in the intestine to you before I turn it over to Rachel to tell you about her experiences, this is actually how I initially became interested in the intestine and inflammatory bowel disease, is that the intestine provides a really great model system for understanding how adult stem cells work, because it's perhaps the most regenerative epithelium in the entire adult. In both mouse and human, the entire epithelial lining turns over every 2 to 5 days, so this is very, very rapid. It's constantly turning over. And it's been known for a long time that the fuel for this is stem cells, which are located at the base of a structure called the crypt. So if you look here at these micrographs, you see here that there are two different structures. This is in the small intestine. These are the villi, where the absorption occurs. And down here are the crypts. And this is a cartoon here. And down at the base of the crypts is where the location of the stem cells is, and these then move out from the base of the crypt, undergo many rounds of proliferation in a zone called the transit amplifying zone, and then they move out as differentiated cells into the villus, where they perform the functions including absorption of nutrients and secretion of various substances. So I'll leave you with that thought of how the intestine regenerates. And now I'd like to turn it over to Rachel Bonner for just a few minutes, who is a 16-year-old high school student. 16, right? High school student, who is an amazing young lady who actually founded a charity called Hope for Crohn's, and she's going to tell you about her story for a few minutes.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Rachel Bonner. I'm 16 years old, and I have Crohn's disease. I was diagnosed 8 years ago when I was 8 years old. Now, before I begin with my story, I'm going to take a different approach. Usually, I'll just stand up, tell my story, and hope everyone just comprehends what I mean. But today, when I leave this room, when I stop speaking, I want everyone to be able to not just understand my story, or pediatric Crohn's patient story, but you'll have the ability to understand what every Crohn's patient's daily struggles are. So with that being said, I'm going to start with a book, which recently was turned into a movie, called The Fault in Our Stars. Well, for those of you who have not seen this movie or read the book, it's an insightful book on the lives of two cancer patients and their friends as they experience life with their disease. Now, ever since the book became huge, I've talked to so many Crohn's patients that have had the ability to connect with that book, whether it's the message, the themes, the ideas. But even though this is a book on cancer patients, everyone has had the ability to connect in some which way or form with the character's experiences, whether it was the gratefulness of having a good nurse and then helping us through our hospital and doctor visits, the effect our diseases have on our friendships, family members, relationships, school, the way others treat us when they find out that we are Crohn's patients, either it's negatively or positively, and lastly, just the way our lives are transformed in a whole by having Crohn's disease. You see, when I was around 12 years old, I went to a camp that was for children with Crohn's or colitis. While I was there, everyone kept talking about how they're afraid to tell their stories. Afraid because they didn't want to be criticized as looking for sympathy. Since Crohn's patient stories are really heartfelt and unimaginable, the patient must have been looking for sympathy, correct? So when I tell you my story, I want you to feel something. I want you to feel understanding, not sympathy, not admiration, but understanding, even if you have no idea what it feels like to take a million blood tests in one day. I just want you to understand that Crohn's is not easy. It isn't a stomach ache that people feel every day, even though that is a symptom. It isn't just passing bowels all the time, even though that can be a symptom. It's probably one of the biggest struggles that anyone that has Crohn's will say. So I'm going to start with the number, 11. It took 11 months for me to be transformed from symptomatic to diagnosed. Many people I've talked to said it takes a few months or a few days, and some people are misdiagnosed, so it takes them even a few years. But it took me 11 months because my symptoms first started out, I started out with hip pain. And so I went to a bone doctor. They did x-rays, MRI scans. I even had a procedure to see if there was fluid in my bones, but it all turned out negative. And Crohn's disease is well associated with having hip pains, so it wasn't thought of at the moment that it would be Crohn's disease. So let's fast forward about 9 to 10 months, and my appetite started extremely decreasing. I lost weight really quickly. I was about 20 pounds or 30 pounds. I was about 4 feet and 6 inches. So then it was suggested that I go and see a gastroenterologist. And I took a stool test, and it turns out that the blood in my stool wasn't visible. It was more so microscopic, and you couldn't really see it that well. And so I took more blood tests, MRI scans, x-rays, and it turned out that I had some type of IBD. So then my gastroenterology team scheduled me to have a colonoscopy and endoscopy, and it turned out I had Crohn's disease. So usually when I get to this point in the story, I like to say it was like a light at the end of tunnel, relief, some type of happiness at the end. And it was relief, but it was false relief in a sense. It was relief to finally be diagnosed, but nothing truly changes. I still missed around 90 out of 180 school days. I was still late to class every day, and I was always tired. I was still made fun of, whether it was the fact that I had a no pee privilege or I got to walk around with one crutch or a cane or a wheelchair, because I had to use diapers and go to the bathroom every single hour, or the fact that I had a renowned pudgy prednisone cheeks, which everyone still assumes I was just a fat kid, but I wasn't. It didn't make a difference whether people knew I had Crohn's disease or not, because apparently that was a excuse behind the real problem. So what you see before you right now, me, I've had 241 medical treatments before I found the one that put me into clinical remission. I tried almost everything. I tried chemotherapies, steroids, NSAIDs, syrups, injections, diets. But I finally came up to my treatment sweet spot, so I like to call it, the place where everything seems to be working out. Every day I wake up and go to sleep hoping that this treatment sweet spot will work until they find a cure. And hopefully the treatment will work indefinitely until that day comes. But it doesn't mean everything is easier. Sure, I don't have to trial through a bunch of different medications, and I don't have to go to the doctors as often. But I still have my bad days where I still have to take my cane to school or take the elevator. I'm playing late to school, and I miss school days. I still get criticized and asked questions, but I guess that's all that comes with the Crohn's territory. So as I conclude, I'm hoping that you're all understanding, not sympathizing, most definitely not admiring, but understanding the daily struggles of a Crohn's patient. But one thing that all Crohn's patients realize after a few years is that Crohn's transforms from a struggle to a badge of honor. I know the day I was diagnosed, I would never stand up here and actually talk about half the things I just said. And I would never have had admitted to wearing a diaper while being in middle school. But Crohn's turned from the secret or struggle to something I want to share with other people, and ultimately to have others understand that the life of a Crohn's patient just a bit more. Thank you.
Dr. Klein, before you go on, Rachel, that was incredible, not just in what you said, but in your poise, your delivery, your eloquence, your willingness to share the story with us. And I speak for everybody here that we are heavily pulling for you, and actually, having heard that, hoping that you develop an interest in science, and one day you'll be standing before us in Dr. Klein's capacity making a presentation on a breakthrough that you'll be working on in the field. So thank you very much.
Rachel also didn't mention that she's an honors student and taking 4 AP classes now, I think, so...
Now that's very easy to believe.
So thank you, Rachel. So what I want to do for the rest of the time is tell you about some of the ongoing work in the lab. And I thought I would start by telling you about the history of stem cells for just one slide, so you can see how the project that we initially did a few years ago got us interested in this. And this is a cartoon showing the base of the crypt. And what you can see is that at the base of the crypt, there are a number of different cells. And the green ones are called crypt-based columnar cells, and the pink ones are called plus four cells because they're four cells above the base of the crypt. And there was a long-standing debate about which of these two cell types actually is the intestinal stem cell, and that's a debate which is still ongoing, although all the evidence seems to be pointing primarily to the green cells, the crypt-based columnar cells. And what happened about seven or 8 years ago, is that two genes were identified. One of these genes, which is called LGR5, marks these crypt-based columnar cells. And when this cell is labeled with using an enzyme that's knocked into this gene locus, using lineage tracing approaches, you can see that there are cells that are labeled here indicating that all of these cells are derived from these crypt-based columnar cells. And similar approaches, although they are a little bit less clear, were done for these plus four cells. And so the debate continues to go on about exactly where the stem cells are, although, again, as I mentioned, the evidence is pointing more and more to the crypt-based columnar cells. And so the initial project that we did was a collaboration with a lab at Genentech led by Fred de Sauvage, who had made a mouse in which we were able to specifically ablate the LGR5 expressing cells. And this is a project that was led by Hua Tian, who was a scientist in Fred's lab at the time. And these cells are also labeled green in this mouse. And so you can see here that there are all these green cells at the base of the crypt. And the experiment is to give a toxin which is specifically taken up by the LGR5 expressing cells at the base of the crypt. And the question was, what happens when we kill all of these cells? And so when we did this experiment, we saw that when we gave the toxin, all of the green cells are gone. You can see that here. And this is looking at them using expression of the gene product. So this indicated us that the system was working. And when we looked a little bit more carefully, what you can see is that these cells at the base of the crypt are very proliferative, and all these proliferative cells are gone here as marked by this protein Ki67. And when we do electron microscopy, you can see that these cells, which have a very specific shape, are also gone. And so all of these experiments indicated to us that using the system, we were able to kill these LGR5 expressing cells. And so the question was, what happens when we kill all of these LGR5 expressing stem cells? And when we looked over about a 10-day period, which is a couple of cycles of renewal of the epithelium, we were very surprised to see that actually the intestine looked totally normal. And we did a lot more experiments that I'm not showing you here, looking at the various cell types. And another interesting observation that we made was that when we withdraw this toxin, the LGR5 expressing cells, which are missing here after several days of ablation, are able to reappear. And so the gut likes to have them. And so the conclusion from this series of studies was that while these LGR5 expressing crypt-based columnar cells, which I'm going to tell you more about in a minute, are indeed the workhorse stem cells of the gut, that the intestine is able to compensate for their absence over at least this 10-day period, which is these two cycles of renewal. And so over the past few years, several other groups have made similar observations using a number of different markers for other intestinal stem cell populations, with the paradigm emerging that there is the ability in the intestine to compensate for the absence of these critical stem cells. And so these, I'm just showing you here some of the papers from other labs that have made similar observations. And even more interesting and also complicated has been the observation that some of the cells which leave the intestinal stem cell niche and begin to differentiate are actually able, under certain conditions, particularly those of damage, to revert and become like stem cells. And this is obviously very important because, as I'll tell you in a minute, and one condition of damage is inflammatory bowel disease. And so we want to understand not only how stem cells normally operate, but also how other cells are able to function in a regenerative capacity under conditions of damage. And so some of the important questions that remain open for us and for many other labs in the field are, what are the factors that regulate and maintain the stem cells? What are the responses of different stem cell populations to modulation of signaling? Can we therapeutically target the stem cells that are normally present or other progenitor cells in the intestine? And can we utilize human embryonic stem cell or induced pluripotent stem cell technology to ameliorate inflammatory bowel disease? So I'll just give you a couple of snapshots of some of the studies that we're doing. So this is a series of experiments that are being done by Roy Nativ, who is a pediatric gastroenterology fellow in the lab. And Roy is using a well-established model of inflammatory bowel disease, which is to give a substance called dextran sodium sulfate, or DSS, which is kind of like a soap. And this causes a colitis, which mimics several aspects of inflammatory bowel disease. And so I'm just showing you up here the timeline. So we give the DSS for 5 days and then withdraw it. And you can see that after that fifth day, the intestinal epithelium is quite perturbed compared to this normal colon here. And then it begins to recover over about 6 days. And so the question that Roy has been investigating is what happens to these LGR5-expressing crypt-based columnar stem cells during this process of DSS-induced damage? And one important and interesting early observation that Roy has made is that after 5 days of this DSS administration, all of the LGR5 crypt-based columnar cells go away. And you can see that there's still, in pink here, is this marker of proliferation, and you can see that there's still a lot of proliferation going on despite the absence of any of the green cells, which are the LGR5-expressing cells. And these LGR5-expressing cells take several days until they fully reappear. And so the question that Roy is now investigating is, what are the cells that are able to perform this regenerative activity in the absence of the stem cells that are normally present, and how do the stem cells reappear? And I'll just mention that there's actually a very interesting published paper from several years ago, actually before the LGR5-expressing cells were identified, which shows that R-spondin-1, which is a ligand for the LGR5 protein, is actually able to ameliorate this DSS-induced colitis. So if you look here, this line is disease activity, and it goes down much more quickly when you treat the mice with R-spondin as opposed to in the controls. And also, if you look histologically, what you can see is that treatment with the R-spondin gives you a much more normal epithelium than in the just the DSS-treated animal. And so now we're interested in understanding how this works. And so just to summarize what Roy is trying to understand is that, as I mentioned, several different cell types have been proposed to act as either reserve stem cells or to be able to de-differentiate from a more committed state into the LGR5-expressing crypt-based columnar cells. And so we're trying to figure out, are these other stem cell populations? Are these progenitors that can revert? What are the cell types that enable regeneration? And now what we're also interested in is understanding what are the signals that control this, because perhaps some of these signals can also be given as drugs to patients. So for the next series of snapshots I want to tell you about is a project being done by Isbrand Nuss, who's a graduate student in the lab. And he came up with this very original project, which is to understand how Helminth infection affects intestinal stem cells. So as many of you are probably familiar, parasitic Helminths infect virtually all animals, all vertebrates, including billions of people in the world. Most of us in this room don't have them because in the developed world, sanitation has enabled us to get rid of them. But actually, in the developing world, billions of people have these. And these are generally not fatal, and there are many, many species of these helminths that affect different vertebrates, but they can cause significant morbidity due to malnourishment and anemia, and they often are also non-symptomatic. As I mentioned, they've been largely eradicated in developed countries. And it's thought that the way that parasites and their hosts have co-evolved over many millions of years has to do with the immune response to helminths, which are not a typical kind of immune response that you'd see when the animal is fighting off a virus or a bacteria, but rather are called a type 2 or Th2 response, which tends not to kill the parasite, but to repel or restrict them. And this is thought to be some sort of mutually beneficial situation, such that the parasite is not killed, but also the host organism doesn't inflict too much damage during trying to fight off this parasite. And so why is this interesting for inflammatory bowel disease? Well, if you look at the parts of the world where there is high rates of helminth infestation, it's the mirror image of the places where there are autoimmune disorders, and including inflammatory bowel disease. And the question of whether Helminths could perhaps be involved in this process and perhaps even be used as a therapy is one which is being pursued in a number of different places in the world, although we still don't have a definitive answer for this. And what is the reason for this mirror image? Well, we don't really know is the bottom line, but the hypothesis is what's called the hygiene hypothesis, which probably many of you have heard about. And that's the idea that historically, humans were, and all animals were, in contact with many different microbiological and parasitic organisms that somehow tamper down the immune response. And in the absence of that, living in a more hygienic world, those inputs are now missing, and so we respond more strongly to them. As I was indicating before when I mentioned at the beginning that IBD is thought to be a response to these commensal bacteria that are normally present in the human. And so this is a patient from UCSF, actually, who was published a few years ago, who self-administered one of these Helminth worms, and he had IBD, and he went to Thailand, I believe, to get these worms. And what you can see here, these are three different years. This is 2007, 2008, and 2009. And I won't walk you through all the details, but the bottom line is that there did seem to be clinical improvement over this three-year period. And this is a therapy which many patients are now trying, although, again, it's not something which has been very well studied. And so our approach has been to try to understand what is the underlying biology of what these Helminths are doing in the gastrointestinal tract. So why look at their impact on intestinal stem cells? Well, it's known in the context of the entire intestine, not specifically regarding intestinal stem cells, that immune reactions to these Helminths can induce expansion of a specific cell called the goblet cell, and this leads to production of mucus, as well as increased turnover of the epithelium. So where would this increased turnover of the epithelium come from? Well, this suggests that perhaps this immune reaction is affecting these epithelial progenitor cells. And as I mentioned, because Helminth therapy is thought to perhaps promote epithelial healing, we thought it would be of interest to study how the host is responding to this Helminth infection. And here I'm just showing you pictures from this is not our work, this is from another group, showing you the expansion of these goblet cells after infection. Okay, so what happens when we give this worm, and in our case, since we're using a mouse model system, we give a worm called Helicmosigmoides, which is a natural mouse Helminth. And so what you can see is that when the worm burrows in, there's a granuloma, which is a collection of immune cells which forms around it, and if you compare that just to the normal gut. And so what Eisbrein was interested in doing was asking, what happens to the intestinal stem cells when this Helminth is provided to the mice? And so the experiment here is basically to infect the mice and then using a chemical which induces the lineage tracing to enable us to follow the progeny of these LGR5 expressing cells to see what happens there. And our initial expectation was that because there are a lot of cells moving into this area, there's a lot of inflammation, that this would lead to increased activity of the stem cells. But actually, we were very surprised to find that compared to the control, where you can see all of these green cells are descendants of the LGR5 expressing cells, that in these three examples you can see here, in all of the cases, when we look right near the granuloma, the stem cells appear to be completely shut off. And so what this tells us is that the microenvironment, the area around the granuloma, has a very profound effect on these intestinal stem cells. And so now what Eisbrein is doing in pursuing his thesis work is trying to understand what are the mechanisms for this. Is this secretion of a certain substance either by the worm or by the immune cells in the granuloma, and how does that regulate the stem cells such that perhaps in the long run, whatever substance that is could be developed into a therapy? And the last snapshot I want to give you is the work that we're doing, and this is CIRM-funded work that we've begun about a year ago, to look at how we can think about both studying and perhaps treating inflammatory bowel disease using pluripotent stem cells. And so this, I should mention, is a close collaboration with Jason Spence's lab at the University of Michigan, who, when he was a postdoc in Cincinnati, actually developed a technique, which I imagine a number of you are familiar with, which is quite amazing. And what this technique is to make intestinal organoids, which are little mini guts, from human embryonic stem cells. And so the process starts with either ESLs or iPSLs, which are then differentiated into endoderm, and then through a series of different manipulations made into cells that look like mid-hindgut, which is a part of the intestine, and then into spheroids and then organoids, which have all of the different components of the adult intestine. And so the kinds of questions that we're interested in pursuing with these are, what are the stem cell populations that are present in these intestinal organoids? Up until now, this has been a question that mostly we and others have addressed using mice, but now because of this organoid technology, we can understand human adult stem cells. Can we use these organoids to understand how the stem cells are regulated? And then I'll show you in the next slide some work from another lab, which is beginning to address this question that we're also interested in, of can these organoids be used therapeutically in inflammatory bowel disease or other intestinal damage situations? And then lastly, can we understand whether native human intestinal stem cells can be harnessed to improve repair? And so this is a really beautiful experiment that was published a couple of years ago in Nature Medicine, in which a group in Japan took adult organoids. These were actually made from intestine, and then did the experiment where they took the DSS, this dextran sodium sulfate model of colitis, treated the animals with it for 5 days, and then injected the organoids into the colon of the mouse. And the question was whether these organoids can integrate and whether this integration is actually able to improve the condition of the mouse. And so what you can see here is, so all the green cells are the organoid-derived cells, and you can see that these cells very beautifully integrate into the colon. And this graph here shows the change in body weight, which is one of the measures of response to the damage. And you can see that those animals in green that were treated with the organoids do slightly better than those that were not. And so this is an initial indication that treatment with these organoids can perhaps help to improve the damage situation. Now, of course, there are many, many open questions in terms of using this kind of cell therapy, obviously where you would get the cells and how you would scale them up. But I think this is a really exciting first step in this direction. And so I want to finish by acknowledging, first of all, the people in the lab who did the work. And I mentioned Hua Tian's work on the LGR5 expressing stem cell ablation. Brian Bees was a postdoc in our lab who helped Hua when she was in Fred's lab to work on this. Roy is the gastroenterologist I mentioned who's doing the DSS work. Unfortunately, Eisbrand, who's doing the worm work, was not at this party, so I don't have his picture in here, but he did all that. Excuse me. All that work. And Chaim Bailenson is a postdoc who's looking at the role of Wnt signaling in the intestine. We've had help from a lot of great collaborators at UCSF. I want to particularly point out Richard Loxley and Adam Savage for the Helminth work, and Mel Heyman and Averill Ma, who are the chiefs of pediatric and adult gastroenterology and have been great sources of support. Fred DeSauvage and his team at Genentech, Jason Spence in Michigan, and Irv Weissman at Stanford, who gave us some nice reagents. And last but definitely not least, and perhaps most importantly, CIRM for all of the funding that we're incredibly grateful for. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thanks, Dr. Klein. Questions? Dr. Lubin.
Do dogs get Crohn's disease?
Do dogs get Crohn's disease?
I mean, you're thinking of helmets and worms, dogs.
Yeah,
worms.
Dogs
have the same worms, but
right. You know, they're honestly, I don't know of a dog model for. I imagine there is one because there are many for human diseases. I don't know of a specific dog model for IBD, but I can check on that and tell you on Saturday when I see you at the retreat.
Sorry, they get it. They get Crohn's disease. So whatever they have. That doesn't necessarily.
Just curious, are there any species of the microbiome that are thought to have positive impact on fighting IBD?
Yeah, there's a lot of work actually on that. Our lab specifically is not working there, but there's a huge area of inflammatory bowel disease biology which is trying to understand. And I think, you know, Rachel was alluding a little bit to this in terms of the diet and its impact on on her condition. That's definitely a huge area of investigation. And we're just beginning a collaboration with a lab at UCSF run by Sue Lynch, which is a microbiome lab, to try to get into that area as well.
Thank you. Other comments for Dr. Klein? Okay, well, thank you very much. And again, thank you, Rachel. It's a very, very good presentation. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.